In the second hour or third hour of our program yesterday, we were covering an interesting revelation. It was from a messenger of Yahweh. It's not from Yahweh himself. It's recorded in the Torah in Bereshith, the 16th chapter. It is regarding the offspring of Ishmael. The conversation is with Hagar, Ishmael's mother. To set the scene here, Yahweh told Abraham that he would have a child. And Abraham and his wife Sarah, who were way up in years, you know, 90, close between 90 and 100 years old between the two of them, just said, he may be God, but he's got no idea about sex because it just ain't happening. And so Sarah, Abram's wife, had a Egyptian maid. He says, hey, you know, it's common in that culture to allow the maid to be used to produce an heir. And they said, why don't we just do it that way? And so Hagar was about to give birth to Ishmael at this time, and God intervened, and he didn't do so personally, but he did intervene to talk to this woman and provide us with a profound prophecy. But it is important to recognize that Abraham even lobbied for Ishmael and said, you know, why can't we let Ishmael be the heir to the covenant? And God said, absolutely not. No, I won't even consider it. Unequivocally, no. So here's this conversation now. It is between a messenger, an envoy of Yahweh, and Hagar. Now, I just want you to think for a moment. Just the possibility. I'm not saying I'm certain this is true. Just think of the possibility for a moment. That this messenger of Yahweh's name is known. And God didn't tell us his name. He just reveals to us what the messenger said. Hillel ben Shakar is a messenger of Yahweh, is he not, Larry?
Well, yeah, he is.
He's a malach, right?
He might be a fallen messenger, but he's a messenger.
He is a malach of Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And those who sided with him are malachs of Yahweh, are they not?
They would have been.
Yeah. So all this says, it says, then a malach of Yahweh said to her. So that there's a possibility that this could be Hillel ben Shakar. And the reason I say it's a possibility here is that Muhammad, just like Paul, admitted that they were possessed by one of Satan's messengers, one of Satan's malach, and that they spoke on behalf of Satan. And there, when you read their revelations, they are purely satanic. And so there really is the possibility, since Satan would engage with Ishmael's offspring to create Islam, whereby Allah is modeled after Satan. It's intriguing to at least consider the possibility. Anyway, this is what was said. Then the messenger of Yahweh said to her, massively numerous will be his offspring, and they will be too numerous to count. And we talked about just briefly yesterday that the world guesses there's around 1.5 billion Muslims. We really don't know. You know, there may be a billion, there may be 2 billion. We don't know. No one knows, because they are breeding like rabbits, and no one's counting. It's impossible to count them. So the statement is absolutely true. And the messenger of Yahweh, the malach of Yahweh, said to her, pay attention to this. You are pregnant with a son. Call his name Ishmael. Ishmael means it's Yod, then Shamael, which is either my God has heard, or individual hears God. From Ish would be individual hears God. I think it's because of the way that God defines it in the next, the messenger, I should say, defines it in the next statement. I would suspect that it is my God has heard. because this is what we read next. Indeed, Yahweh has heard, Shama, of your affliction. This is El Oni, of your poverty, of your misery, of your lowly status, of your wretched nature, of your complete dependency, of your distress, your suffering, it's from Anav, from your browbeating, your affinity for oppression and persecution, your misery and prostrate nature, willingness to bow down.
Wow.
So Oni is a very revealing term, particularly in light of Ishmael being symbolic of Islam. We don't say that just casually, of course.
Yeah,
prostration part, oppression, persecution, misery, browbeating, distress, suffering, wretched nature, dependency. You know, all of that is directly appropriate when talking about Islam. And with Ishmael, Muhammad claimed to be a descendant of Ishmael. Whether Muhammad was or not, we have no clue. But the reality is that he claimed to be a descendant of Ishmael. He claimed that the Islamic covenant with Allah was based upon Ishmael, and that Islam is based on that covenant that was made between Allah and Ishmael. And so when we read Ishmael and think of his descendants, we're looking at today's Muslims. And the messenger of Yahweh, the Malak, said this. And he, this is speaking of Ishmael and his descendants, shall actually and continually be, this is Haya, this was written in the Call Imperfect. The Call says, and we're talking about demonstrable truth here. We're not talking about hypothetical situations. You need to view these words literally. That's what the Call stem conveys. And the imperfect conjugation means that what we're talking about here isn't going to be something that has a period where it's true and then it ceases to be a problem. It says that by the imperfect, it means that from the get-go and for an ongoing period without cessation, this is what they're going to be like. Okay? And he shall actually and continuously be, Haya, a wild ass, Pere, a wild donkey of a man. And his hand will be against everyone, Ba Hakol. And everyone's hand will be against him. Also, in opposition to the very presence of all of his brothers, he will live. All right, it sounds like if you were to write a headline for the Sunnis fighting the Shia jihadists in Syria, that this would be a pretty darn appropriate headline.
Yeah, and it would be. Yeah, and you could throw in the whole area there in Africa where they wiped out everybody of color. Now they're wiping out everybody that there's, and Christian, by the way, too. And
right.
Then they're wiping out everybody that's didn't have Arabic as their first language. I mean, it's just, if there's always a reason to wipe more people out, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of the Muslims, but just anywhere that Islam is raging today, and he shall actually and continuously be a wild ass of a man. And his hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. And in opposition to the presence of his brothers, of Kol Ah, his relatives, his clan, his associates, his countrymen, he will live.
I once saw a honor killing. I really did. I saw it on YouTube. And do you know why this looked to be a teenage boy beat his teenage sister to death with a brick? People just stood around and filmed it.
Yeah, the last murders I watched on film of Islam was about 2 months ago. I can only do it, you know, periodically because I'm already so enraged against the religion of Islam. But I watched it. It was posted by the Roman Catholic Church. The Sunni rebels, the ones that America, John McClown wants to arm, that says are really good guys, had captured a Christian town. And the Sunni Muslim jihadists, sought to rape, the Christian women, and they wanted to start with the nuns in this, monastery that was in this, Syrian town. And there were two, priests who tried to stop the Muslim jihadists from raping the nuns. And so of course they tied the men up, and then they continued to rape the nuns, and then they brought the men out before, the community of Muslims. And there's these two, Catholic priests, both, in their, late 40s, early 50s. And they were bound, head and foot. And then there was about 10,000 eyewitnesses. They let the women and children, particularly young children, come up to the front. And they had this kind of cathedral seating, if you will, a stadium seating around it. Of course, it was just a ravine, but the way the people, so many people could see. And then the leader of the rebel group of the Sunni Muslims, the jihadists, began to speak about how these two men had fought against the cause of Allah, and how Allah had judged them, and how Allah was greater than their God. And all the women and children would begin to kick and spit at these two priests as they chanted Allahu Akbar, and as they cited Quranic verses to taunt these two men. And then they had the children take the knife and slowly, over a long period of time, cut off both men's heads.
Yep. I've seen them. I've seen them worse than that. I've seen them burn them alive. Just crazy stuff out there. And when you can do that, you know, we all know there's deranged people that murder other people, but there's not too many people that do it in the name of their God.
Boko Haram in Nigeria just 2 days ago, 3 days ago, attacked Christian communities, and they surrounded homes and churches to lock the people inside, and they burned them alive. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We were talking about Yahweh's prediction that those who claimed Ishmael as their forefather would actually and continuously be wild asses of men, that their hand would be against everyone and everyone's hand would be against them, and then opposition to the very presence of all of their brothers they would live. That struck me when you said that there aren't many people that commit such savage acts in the name of their God as do Muslims. I do want to bring this a little closer to home, Larry. I was writing a document which I called America's 101 Wars. And in the first of those wars, it is against, it's the European colonialists fought against the local Indian tribes in the Virginia area. And they surrounded a Indian encampment. The men were out hunting, and it was just women and children in the encampment, many hundreds of them. They surrounded the encampment, and then they prohibited anyone to leave. And then they set fire to it and burned the women and children alive in the encampment. Now, the reason I'm sharing that story is the man who supervised that massacre wrote that it had been the work of his God. He was Christian, and he talked about how his Lord rounded up the savages, and that he was the one that lit the fire, and that he burned them because they were savages. So it does happen.
Oh, well, I mean, you had a 1,400-year Inquisition where torture was the, you know, I mean, they would torture you out of your money if you wouldn't give it to them. I mean, that's really what was going on. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, today the RCC stands as the wealthiest church church in the world, for sure. I think the wealthiest organization of any kind, but sure. I mean, it's been done. I should have prefaced that with today you don't expect to see it. But, you know, I've read the Extreme Jesuit Oath, and it says the same thing. Take their babies and beat their heads against the wall and everything else if they're not Catholic. So,
you know, I read a report today that they're very close to civil war in the Ukraine. When I read about the pogroms that the Ukrainians perpetrated prior to and during World War One and after World War One, where their Ukrainian officials would go into a Jewish home and take an infant and swing the infant around their heads by holding the infant's feet and bang the infant's head into walls in front of their parents. You know, you see the same thing. These were primarily Roman Catholics that tormented Jews in this way. Muhammad, when he raided Kabar, which was the origin of Allahu Akbar, he went to the wealthiest Jewish family in the community, and because this fellow knew that there was a chance that Muhammad and his goons might raid them, he had buried the community's wealth. And Muhammad supervised the man's torture, took a hot stick of iron out of the fire, and began to torture the man until the man finally confessed where the treasure was.
Well, so ultimately, this is really the spirit of religion. I mean, Yahweh is not a religious deity. You cannot beat that into people's heads, by the way. They have a love affair with somebody lording over with them, and they have to be in submission. So I guess their idea of a good time is being prostrate in submission, singing praise like a Hallmark greeting card to a religious deity for all eternity.
And I want to be really careful here, too, that it is true that Christianity and Islam both have motivated mass extinctions of people and have been brutally savage. But I don't want the atheists and agnostics who might form an affinity with socialist secular humanism to think that their institution gets off scot-free. And the last
killed 100 million people in the last century. You know.
Yeah, the last century, socialist secular humanists have murdered over 100 million people. So it is actually the most deadly religion that man has ever conceived is the religion of man. Larry, we have Glenn on the line, and would love to hear what you have to say, Glenn. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Pretty tough stuff, pretty gruesome stuff. Now,
yes.
All this, I mean, you spoke of decapitation, of people being burned. Oh, do you have a little break?
Yeah, we're going to go for a short break, but we'll be back right at the bottom of the hour. So please stay with us, Glenn, and we'll bring you up the moment we return to Shattering Mist. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. Just at the very bottom of the hour as the music began to play, Glenn had called in and wanted to share some thoughts, and I promised we'd return to Glenn right at as we participate in the rejoin. So, Glenn, the stage is yours.
When you guys were talking about all these executions, you know, you spoke of decapitations and you spoke of people being burned. I mean, hypothetically, if you were to be executed, would you prefer to be burned at the stake or decapitated?
Boy, I mean, there's a real... No, first of all, I don't think anyone's ever been given that choice.
Would you like some hemlock with that or cyanide?
Yeah, I mean...
I thought he was just flip a coin, assuming you had to choose.
When you're talking, both are extraordinarily painful and slow death. And they're designed, specifically designed to be public executions. Both are public so as to condition the people. Say, hey, if you step out of line and if you no longer agree with us, this will be done to you. And they were agonizing in public. And so, you know, there are.
For the sake of the exercise, we'll specify a guillotine.
I'll take the guillotine. I understand that we're storing them over here these days.
I'm afraid I have to disagree on the basis that a hot steak beats a cold chop any day. Sorry.
That's okay.
You guys walked right into it with both citing both.
Yeah, you're right.
When we're talking about the violence, as far as I'm concerned, given the ubiquity of sin, all people groups and all ideologies resort to it. A wicked person will hide behind any ideology, religion, political ideology, or the absence thereof if they're intent on doing. I mean, let's not forget a recently departed butcher of Sabra and Shatia, and those who poisoned him and killed Itzhak Rabin. All people groups do it.
Yeah, you know, the problem and the reason we bring this up as a collective issue is that while people individually on occasion are prone to be really repulsive, for the most part, the worst of human behavior is associated with group activity. And that the gang, and the gang mentality, particularly if the gang is large, that people will forego individual responsibility, forego individual morality as part of a group. So when you get a religion that's as savage as Islam, for example, or a religion like socialist secular humanism based upon the Machiavellian concept of the ends justified the means, then people in groups, in institutions, are far more likely to be savages than they are individually. So I still think that while you are right that individuals have always acted badly throughout time, there is a reason that we discuss religious indoctrination and political indoctrination and patriotism, because in institutions, human behavior is more savage than it is individually.
Well, I don't think I've ever – I would not ever expect, though, and as bad as people are over here, and I'll just throw this in and jump right out, but if you had a woman being beaten to death with a brick in the middle of a town center where people are shopping and whatnot, I think that guy would have been stopped. But, what I witnessed was a guy picking up a big brick and keep throwing it on his sister's head, and everybody just sat around and filmed it with a cell phone. I couldn't imagine that somebody wouldn't step up to the plate over here. We have a lot of cowards, but
I know my own behavior. I seen that, recognizing that I would be risking my life and the implications of that for my wife and my children that I would leave behind. I would be the person who would say I would risk my life to try to stop that. And and for most people, when you do that, you are making a decision in that case that you're risking your life to stop it. And there isn't much motivation for most people.
A woman that was getting raped one day when there was 10 people standing above it. It was actually in the middle of the night. I could hear her screaming from two blocks away with my car window down. So I have no trouble running into something like that.
You and I are both fairly immune to fear and motivated to do that kind of thing. Got away with it, probably because of the fact you were a bodybuilder, you were a SEAL, you were trained to be able to do that kind of thing, and you had the courage and compassion to pull it off. I've always tried to fight against evil using words. I've been at the wrong end of a gun many times, and I've always tried to use reason to get the perpetrator to back down. I've not always had good luck with it. Sometimes I have, but I cannot universally claim to have prevailed with my words.
Well, I haven't been on the wrong end of a gun too often, but wow, okay.
Yeah, I have many times because, again, I do not exercise the normal level of fear that most people have. So I've talked with Glenn on this program. I recognize what my liabilities are, and, to do a show like this where you make yourself vulnerable, most people would say, that's probably not a smart thing to do. But, it's after a while, you've just got to say, what really am I risking for? What is the potential gain? And so I have a tendency to jump in. But I jump in with my words.
Jump in. I would not watch somebody beat somebody to death and just stand there, especially a woman. And I don't. But I don't think that anybody could have gotten away with that in the middle of a busy town center.
You know, it's not, you know, in America now, the tendency is that more people are prone to watch and to film it than to act. The vast majority of incidents that I have read about as I, you know, I study the news every day, and the vast majority of incidents now show that, that while people are willing to help somebody get out of a car that, that is burning, that if someone is perpetrating harm on another person, like raping them, are beating them, that the vast preponderance of Americans now are unwilling to engage unless the person being attacked is someone who is close to them.
No, that's bad news.
Yeah, I can tell you what my biggest concern in all of this, and I think about it quite often, is that I recognize we're moving to a totalitarian state. I watch a lot of the films now on the arrest of individuals where the police will come with their guns raised to a person who is unarmed and yell at that person and tell that person to lie down like an animal on the ground and to spread their legs, and then they'll jump on top of them, and then they will handcuff them, and they will treat the person as if they are vicious and that they're a criminal. And they command the person to respond in this demeaning way. And I recognize my own nature. I'm going to rebel against that. So if, you know, as we move towards this tendency for law enforcement to treat people with such utter contempt, you know, I'm not going to do it. You know, if a policeman tells me, you know, lay down on the ground and put your hands on, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, I've seen tons of those as well. I've exposed them on my FB page, but it appears that nothing ever really happens to these thugs.
No, the cops. Yeah, the cops that are doing it. And I realize that they're so indoctrinated, these people are, and they're so deranged in their thinking that the chances are is I'm going to get shot because I'm not going to lie down to the ground. I'm not going to put my hands over my head. You know, I'm going to use my words again. I'm going to say, I have never struck anyone. I am. You're not going to be the first. I am not armed. I have done nothing wrong. You need to calm down. And, you know, it's not going to work.
Yeah, they don't actually. What I've seen is it's just been brutal. Brutal. There was a guy that was just beaten to death out in California, and a jury. I mean, his beating took 10 minutes, and it was two guys that had to weigh, each of them 250. They were both overweight. This guy weighed 145 pounds, maybe.
Yeah.
And they were on him. They were crushing him. He was screaming for help. Telling him he couldn't breathe. One of them even, after they shocked him with a taser while they had him down there, beat his face in with the handle of it. Well, 2 days later, he died.
Yeah.
And you know, the jury that watched the same film I did, let the cops walk.
Yeah. You know, there's that case in New Mexico or Arizona where a woman driving her children was taking her children, you know, on a vacation, and cops pulled them over, and the cop was so belligerent in his tone, the woman was afraid for her life and afraid for her children. So she began to pull away. So she wanted, you know, if I'm going to have to deal with this cop, I want it to be in a public place where I'm safer. And so they called for a backup, and the backup got down on his knees and began to shoot at the car with the young children inside. One of the cops knocked the window out of the car and tasered the 16 or 17-year-old son that was trying to defend the mother against the harassment of the cop. And the woman and her son were arrested, and the cops were not.
I hadn't heard of this one, but there's hundreds of them out there.
Hundreds of them out there, and that's what we are becoming, a police state. It is this kind of brutality that this passage spoke of, which is directed at Islam. But as a society, particularly with institutional behavior like police force, we are becoming an extraordinarily totalitarian and brutal society. We become the police state that we used to despise.
Yana?
Yes.
Well, what's the chief attribute of the world in the time of Noah in Genesis 6? You know, when the Adam and Eve shall be coming of the Son of Man be. What's the chief attribute of the world? It was filled with violence.
Yeah, savage. Yeah, the
savage, the
yeah, the
world.
Right. The actually the your description is the best translation of the word is violent, but they were institutionally savage, and their brutality towards fellow human beings was why Yahweh said, I've got to deal with this, because if this level of institutional savagery persists, then the world's not going to endure to year 6,000, Yah, which is when I plan. You know, my plan is based upon that. You guys aren't going to, you'll have to destroy yourself before that time unless I intervene at this point. And so you're right. It was, so what your point is that we have returned to what we once were.
What? And you mentioned Markin. Consequentialist ethics versus non-consequentialist ethics, utilitarian ethics. This has been formalized academically and socio-politically.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the violence that we perpetrate on our fellow man is much greater today and is much more prone to be justified today. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. This is the last segment of our program today, and I do want to transition back into the Torah's presentation of the covenant. We're going to rejoin in the fourth meeting between Yahweh and Abraham. His covenant relationship with this man was continuing to be defined and developed. It is about an adoption process whereby, once adopted into the covenant family, Abraham was going to receive the benefits of the covenant, which is to be perfected, to become immortal, to be part of God's family, to be enriched and to be empowered. And it's why, during this forced meeting, Abraham was called a son, while he was actually an old man by any other standard. He is still a son to God. And our Heavenly Father was in the process of adopting Abraham, as he does us. And the fact that Abraham was this old when 99 years old during this time also reminds us that it's never too late. We can come to know Yahweh and engage with him at any point in our lives. This statement reads, and this is from Bereshit, the 17th chapter, first statement. And Abram, which means uplifting father, had actually become a son of 99 years. And Yahweh appeared as God to Abram. And he said to him, I am God Almighty. Choose of your own volition to walk toward my presence and literally come to be perfect. It's one of the more misunderstood statements, I think, in the whole of the Torah.
And unless somebody understands what the covenant promises are, they don't get that. No,
right. Yeah, so it is God telling Abraham that he is to, of his own capability, his own mannerisms, his own character, become perfect?
No.
No. As a matter of fact, even after this point, Abraham will have some fairly significant blunders, won't he?
Well, sure he will.
Yeah.
He has a baby with the slave.
Right. Yeah. Well, he's just gotten off of that. So the reality is that that God is being very specific here. He has used walk a number of times in presenting the covenant. For example, he said he wants him to walk away from his country, which was Babylon, to walk away from his societal customs, to walk away from the father's home to the place that God was going to provide. And God then showed him that place, which was heaven and the nature of life in heaven as the light of stars. So now he's telling to Abraham, he says, choose of your own volition. So this is being presented, this walk, with the Hebrew word for walk, which is to move in a direction. He wrote it in the Hifpael imperative. The imperative is not a command in Hebrew, except in extraordinarily rare cases. It is a presentation of volition.
Well,
so it means
to
choose.
Not because he's saying thing of your own free will.
Right, yeah. So choose of your own volition to walk. Of your own accord, come, travel, journey through life, and come to exist as a unique individual, engaging and proceeding. And then it's the next word is law. Law is a preposition in Hebrew. It means to move toward. It's not just to, but it's more toward, to come into the presence of someone, to enter into their company. So God is saying here, I am God Almighty. Choose of your own volition to walk toward my presence, pene, my existence, my side, my face. And literally come to be, haya, perfect. Haya, the verb here, which is the operative verb and come to be, is it's a rather important verb, isn't it, Larry? Haya.
Yeah, it's the very basis of Yahweh's name, existence.
Right. When Yahweh introduced himself to Abraham at the when the burning top of the mountain, he said, "Ihaya asher ihaya." I exist. I am that which I am. And I am, I was, I will be.
You get
right? It's Hayah.
Stuck on that, and they say, well, that's what he told Moses. That's what his name was. No, he was saying, I am real.
I exist.
As opposed to say, I'm right. A down there that's an ass.
And, of course, the next statement out of Yahweh's mouth is, tell the children of Israel that Yahweh has sent you. That is my one and only name. That is the only way that I want to be known and remembered. We'll pick up at this point in our program tomorrow, and we'll consider what Yahweh meant when he said of your own volition, walk toward my presence and become perfect.